second chapter of Ruth, and I want to read this chapter. Remember, we talked about the different titles for each of the chapters when we started the study of Ruth, and the Bible school calls chapter 2 a humble heart, which I thought was a really good title. Brother Schofield titles this chapter Ruth Serving, and Brother Ironside titles this chapter Meeting with Christ. I thought that was an interesting title because Boaz is going to be a type of Christ. I title this chapter Submission, and you see in this chapter Ruth's submission to Naomi and her submission to Boaz. My Ryrie Bible titles this chapter Ruth's Rights, and she's going to lay hold of her rights here. Her right to glean, and the results of her gleaning, and the report of her gleaning. She's going to come back to Naomi with a report, but this is about her right to glean, which she's going to exercise. Brother Wiersbe, that we've been talking about, I never gave you his outlines for each of the chapters, and for chapter 1, he calls chapter 1, he titles it Sorrow, and then after Sorrow, he has Ruth Weeping, because, you know, she doesn't want to leave Naomi. In chapter 2, he titles chapter 2, Service. And he has after that, Ruth Working. In chapter 3, he titles that Submission. And after that, he has Ruth Waiting. And chapter 4, he titles Satisfaction. And after that, he has Ruth's Wedding. I thought that was really good. You have sorrow and serving and submission and satisfaction. Just thought those are really good. And I suggested when you go through and read this chapter, go through and see if you can come up with a title for the chapter. I went through and of course I came up with that title of submission, but also I kind of outlined the whole chapter. And I've got an a title for each verse, which I thought was kind of a challenging way of looking at that chapter and reading about it. So we're going to read the chapter. And chapter 2 says, "And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, Let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, Go, my daughter. And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and her hap was to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said unto the reapers, The Lord be with you. And they answered him, The Lord bless thee. Then said Boaz unto his servant that was set over the reapers, Whose damsel is this? And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, This it is the Moabitish damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came, and hath continued even from the morning until now, that she tarried a little in the house. Then said Boaz unto Ruth, Hearest thou not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field that they reap, and go thou after them. Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee? And when thou art athirst, go into the vessels and drink of that which the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground, and said unto him, Why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou shouldest take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger? Now, verse 2 starts out with this assurance that she has in her heart, I shall find grace. But when she finds it, she says, Why have I found grace in thine eyes? And that's the way it is between us and the Lord. We come to the Lord Jesus Christ, and he meets our need, and we say, why have I found grace in thy eyes? And it's grace means that which is a gift that is freely given with no expectation of anything in return, and it's given not because we deserve it, but simply because the one that gives it wants to. And we didn't deserve anything, and yet Jesus came and gave us that wonderful gift of life. And we say to him from time to time, and especially when we first receive it, why have I found grace in thine eyes? And Boaz answered and said unto her, and he's going to give her a little answer here, it hath fully been showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people which thou knowest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust. Then she said, let me find favor in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thine handmaiden, though I be not like unto one of thine handmaidens. And you know, I was reading, we're going to learn when we study this chapter, that there was a provision made for widows and orphans and the strangers in the land that were poor to go out into the field and glean from the fields. But one of the commentators said it was up to the individual owner of that field whether he would choose to let that person glean in the field. You know, he could
stop people from.
Yeah, he could say, I don't want you gleaning in my field.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the provision was there for them, but that owner could say, I don't want you here. Go glean in another field. Remember, Ruth is from Moab, an enemy of Israel. And she says to him, why are you being so kind to me? Why have you spoken so favorably to me? I don't think she expected somebody to treat her so nicely or to say, yes, go ahead and glean in this field. She may have expected somebody to turn her away because, well, she's from Moab and there are enemies. So just because the Word of God says something and makes the provision, in order for that provision to be fully enjoyed, the other party has to carry it out and be willing to supply. And Boaz was a godly man. In verse 14, and Boaz said unto her, at mealtime come thou hither and eat of the bread and dip thy morsel in the vinegar. And she sat beside the reapers, and he reached her parched corn, and she did eat, and she was sufficed, and she leapt. You know, he didn't have to offer her any food. And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not. And let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, or on purpose for her, and leave them that she may glean them, and rebuke her not. So she gleaned in the field until even, and beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And my Bible says about 20 quarts. That's quite a bit. She started early, and she broke just that brief time. And remember, we studied that barley is the first crop, and it was the crop that was usually used to feed the animals, but it also was what the poor would eat. And she took it up, in verse 18, and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. And she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. And her mother-in-law said unto her, where hast thou gleaned today? And where wroughtest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee. You know, I think she was wondering how Ruth would be treated are accepted. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, the man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said unto her, daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord, who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said unto her, the man is near of kin unto us, one of our next kinsmen. And Ruth the Moabitess said, he said unto me also, thou shalt keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest. So she's going to glean through the barley harvest and the wheat harvest and every other harvest that he has, maybe the grape harvest and the olive harvest. And Naomi said unto Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens, that they meet thee not in any other field. So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest and of the wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. Isn't that a wonderful chapter? You know, in this chapter you see Ruth meeting Boaz, and then you see Boaz speaking unto his servants, and then Boaz speaking unto Ruth, and Ruth's response to him, and her, and then Boaz's answer to her questions, and her gratitude, and then you see Boaz's provision, and then Ruth returning home with that provision. So I think this will be a really good chapter that has a lot of good lessons for her. She in this chapter, in verse 2, is going to exercise her right to glean. But throughout it all, you see that submission to her mother-in-law, because she's going to ask her permission. And her submission at the end of this chapter is to her mother-in-law. And in between is her submission to Boaz. So you just see that wonderful attitude of heart. And out of all the characteristic traits that we have as a child of God, this is the one that I think chafes the most against us. It's the one that we resist the most, because we do want to be independent. And yet this is the testimony of the Lord Jesus Christ. He submitted to his Father's will. I do always those things that please my Father. And he is our example, and his life within us enables us to show forth that very same example. So we look at this first verse, and in that first verse, you have the kinsman, and in verse 2 you have the Moabitess, and in verse 3 you have the gleaning, and in verse 4 you have the reapers. So I've had a title for each of those verses. In verse 1, the one person that our eyes are focused on is somebody called the kinsman. And in verse 2, our eyes are focused on Ruth. And in verse 3, on what she does, the gleaning. And on verse 4, the reapers. So we look at the kinsman here, and we find that it says, and Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. So did Naomi have a kinsman? From reading chapter 1 and some of the arguments that she gave to Ruth for why you shouldn't come with me, you got the idea that she really didn't think she had any kinsman. That, I'm sorry, there's nobody, I can't provide for you any sons to marry, and basically there isn't anybody that I know that can either. So you get this idea that she's, of course, she's been gone 10 years, and so she doesn't really realize what's available for her. Now, the word kinsman in verse 1 is a little bit different than the word kinsman in verse 20. The word kinsman in verse 1 is a Hebrew word that just means an acquaintance. It's not the word in verse 20 that means one who redeems. There's a deeper meaning to that word. So the first thing that I want you to think about when Naomi says, oh, or the word says Naomi had a kinsman, is just the general idea of there was a general relationship, a family relationship. At first you only see the relationship and it's kind of a distant one, a kinsman of her husband's. Now, when you get to verse 20, she's going to say, this man is near of kin. He's not just a kinsman, he's near of kin. He's close, closer than I thought I would have. He's one of our very next kinsmen, which is going to show a unique relationship. So I thought about this in this sense. Neither one is aware of the other at this time, only God is. You know, Boaz isn't really aware of Naomi until she comes back, and Naomi isn't really aware of Boaz until she comes back, but God is. And so a lot of times when the Lord leads us down a pathway, step by step, and we don't understand the direction that we're going and we want to go in another direction, He really knows what's ahead of us, and He'll make the provision for us. Now, if Naomi had said, I'm sorry, Ruth had said to Naomi, I'm sorry, I want to stay in Moab. It's easier here. She would have never met Boaz. But she followed the leading of the Lord, and the Lord provided for her. So even though neither one seems to be aware of the other at the time, God is. The other thing is, even if she had heard about Boaz when she had left, she doesn't mention him in the first chapter. She doesn't say, oh, I have a really near kinsman that we can go to and he'll make provision for us. She doesn't even think about that. Later on, when she's aware of him, she's going to claim that deeper relationship. And the obligation to redeem is going to come from that claim on that deeper relationship. So when you look at our relationship with the Lord, a lot of God's people have this loose, distant, vague idea of a relationship with Jesus. But once you realize how close you can be to Him, how near He can be to you, then and only then can you approach Him and appropriate from Him the provision that He is willing to supply for your lives. And so the obligation to redeem rests upon the next kinsman or the near of kin, but she's got to make the claim. And so she's got to realize he's not just a kinsman, he's a near kinsman. So Strong's Encyclopedia said, for the word kinsman, there are four Hebrew words that are translated in the King James Version as kinsman or kinswoman. And the first three words indicate just a simple relationship. It's translated as kinswoman in Numbers 27:11, and kin in Leviticus 18:12. So, you know, that's just a simple relationship. It's translated kinswomen, plural, in Leviticus 18:17. So that those three aspects, kinswoman and kinswomen, are just a loose, general, simple relationship. It's also translated here in Ruth, acquaintance. If you look it up in the Hebrew, it means an acquaintance. So it comes under that simple relationship. And she just doesn't realize how deep it can be. And that's what I want you to think about tonight, that we each of us have a relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, but it can be a lot deeper than it is. It's a matter of being aware of how much we can lay hold of Him and how much He'll be willing to provide for us. The other third word that's used, the first is kinswoman or kin. The second word is kinswomen or kinsman here. And the third is kinsfolk. And that's used in Job 19:14. If you were in the Ozarks, you'd say kinfolk, wouldn't you? And that would cover your cousins, your second cousins, your third cousins, your fourth cousins, your uncles, your great uncles, your great aunts, you know, covered loosely everybody. But those three Hebrew words just show a general, simple relationship, but there's a fourth word, which we see in verse 20 of chapter 2. And in the English, it looks like it's the same word. But in the Greek, it's a totally different, or Hebrew, it's a totally different word. The word in the Greek is G-O-E-L. G-O-E-L. The Greek word in chapter 1 is, a Hebrew word in chapter 1, verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1 is, see, I looked that up. It is Moda, M-O-D-A. So Naomi had a kinsman, the Hebrew is Moda, M-O-D-A. In 20, the man is near kin of us, one of our next kinsmen, that's G-O-E-L. Totally different word. Which I was really surprised. I just thought they'd be the same. This word, the last meaning of this word, is the word that's really going to be prominent in this chapter. And it means not just having a relationship with somebody, a near relationship, a simple relationship, but it has attached to that first meaning, relationship, that there's a certain obligation arising out of that relationship that applies to the person. So you can be a kinsman and have just a general relationship, and you can be a kinsman, and because you meet that second definition, there's an obligation that you are responsible for because you have that closer relationship. And the obligation, and that word comes from a verb that means to redeem. So the next kinsman, the foundation of that word has to do with redeeming somebody. And it means, you know, to come to the help of somebody or to rescue somebody or to give that person protection or also to avenge them of a wrong that has been done to them. So the kinsman, there's a slayer of the kin, avenger of the blood, which is a kinsman. And if somebody murdered a family member, that kin person took on the title of avenger of blood. And he had a right to avenge the death of a family member and hunt down the person that did it, unless that person happened to flee to a city of refuge. But as far as Boaz is concerned, this meaning, and we'll look at it in a deeper level when we get to verse 20, gives him an opportunity to reach out to Naomi and reach out to Ruth and offer them help and offer them protection and rescue them and, in a sense, redeem what they have lost. Here he's already, whether he realizes it or not, exercising that responsibility on a deeper level because he's already helping Ruth. He's going above and beyond what is expected, letting her sit down at the table and eat, letting her glean and not chastising her if she breaks some of the rules that they set aside for the gleaners and making sure that she has more than enough. So here he's exercising that right because, in a sense, he's more aware of that relationship that they have than Naomi is. And when you look at our relationship with Jesus, he's more aware of that relationship than we are. And he's the one that reaches out to us first. So we find here this particular relationship of next kinsman that you see in verse 20 would apply to the male that was the nearest blood relative to that individual. And there were three rights that he would have the right to exercise. He could redeem property that had been lost. Remember, Naomi's husband had died, and her sons had died. What happened to their property? It needs to be redeemed. They've been gone for 10 years. Who's paid the taxes on the property? Maybe it's gone back to, you know, whoever. And so in order for Naomi to obtain that property again, somebody's going to have to pay the penalty, pay the taxes on it. He could redeem that property. If there was a person that had sold themselves into bondage because of debt, he could redeem that person and pay that debt and they would go free. And as the third one, he could be the avenger of blood. If somebody in his family had been murdered, he could go out and exact retribution. But we don't see that in the first verse. We see Naomi willing to lay hold of that in the 20th verse. But in the first verse, God is aware of that. And all Naomi is aware of, in a sense, is, I have a kinsman. And when she hears how he treats Ruth, she realizes, ooh, he's more than a kinsman. He's more than just an acquaintance. Now look how Boaz is described here. We see that Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's. So he's on her husband's side of the family. Now some commentators think that he could have been a great uncle or he could have been a cousin. It doesn't really say here exactly what his relationship is. There's a lot of speculation, great uncle or cousin, but he was on her husband's side of the family. So because of that, he has a right that he wouldn't have had. If he'd been on her side of the family, it wouldn't have been the same. Look at how he's described here. You see his status, his family, and his name. He was a mighty man of wealth. That's his status. His family, he was of the family of Elimelech. And his name is, he had the name of Boaz. You know, it's rather interesting. Only when Ruth steps out in faith, only when she goes from verse 1 to verse 2 and says, let me go, and she gets down to verse 3 and she enters into a field, only when she steps out in faith will she meet Boaz and lay claim to him, in a sense. And that's the way it is in the things of the Lord. When you step out in faith, that's when you meet Jesus in a greater way. And that's when you begin to lay claim to that which he can provide for you. So if she had stayed at home and said, excuse me, I really don't want to go do manual labor. There's been a lot of speculation over who Ruth was. And some of the Jewish commentators say she was the granddaughter of the king of Moab. I don't know where they get that. That's speculation. She probably was, since Elimelech and Naomi were wealthy. She probably was from a wealthy background. So whether she was extremely wealthy or just upper middle class wealthy, I don't think they would have married a pauper to their son. They were. But what I wanted you to think about was, I think that actually she was from a background where she probably didn't glean in the fields for a living. You know, she didn't maybe do manual labor for a living. And so for her to be willing to do this is really quite something, to be willing to, for her living and provision, providing for herself and Naomi, to go out and work from dawn till dusk, picking up the leftover grain in the field, day in and day out, day in and day out, for the whole time that the crops are being harvested. You know, that's a long, hot, hard, weary day. And she was willing to do that. So my point is, she had to be willing in faith to step out and do that in order to even meet Boaz in the first place. So when we look at Boaz, the first thing we see about him, he's described three ways. We see he was a mighty man of wealth. The word mighty has to do with, it means warrior. It means powerful. It means a champion of sorts, or a chief. So that obviously some of the commentators feel, had some military background. Of course, in Israel today, everyone in Israel serves in the military. Now, whether they rise up in the ranks in the military, or they just do that obligatory time of service and then go on with the rest of their life, you don't know. But say Netanyahu, who is high up in the military, he's been in the military all his life. David Ben-Gurion, who was the founder, the first prime minister in Israel, was a military man. So that we find here, when you see the word mighty, you have the idea that he was mighty in the sense that he had a military background. He had probably fought some battles. He was considered powerful. He was considered strong. But he also was a mighty man of what? Wealth. And the word wealth there means, of course, riches or power. But it also means strength or valor, which really strength and valor have the idea of something to do with the military. And so I thought about Boaz. These describe his strength and not just the wealth of this man, but also the spiritual temper of that man. Because one of the definitions in the Geneva Bible is power both in virtue and in authority and in riches. So there was a virtue in this man, there was an authority that he could exercise in this man, and there were riches. Well, he owned fields. And he had reapers in those fields. This is just probably one of his fields. And so he probably had several fields. So we see here his standing among God's people, I think militarily and materially he stood out. I think physically and spiritually he stood out. He was a strong man. We don't know how old he was. I think he was a mature man, but we do know that he was a mighty man of valor, a mighty man of wealth. My commentary said the Hebrew words translated mighty man of wealth. I wanted to remind you of this. There are two other men in the Bible that are called this. These same words are used of Gideon and Jephthah, each of whom was called a mighty man of valor, or a mighty warrior in the original. They were men of valor, capable, efficient, worthy in battle. Boaz was a mighty man of valor, capable in his community. You know, and so I wanted us to look at these two scriptures, because one of the things that I wanted us to focus on was, when you look at Gideon and this title that's given to him, and you look at the next man and the title that's given to him, and all you have to do is go back one book, you're in Ruth, just go back to Judges, which is, you know, just before Ruth, and go to chapter 6. But what I wanted you to think about is Gideon and Jephthah were two judges who I think may not have looked like mighty men of valor. And what struck me was God knew what they were capable of and what they were before they did. So when we look at Boaz, in order for him to be outwardly known by this title, he must have already gone through a time of testing or time of battle that proved him and brought forth these qualities, which is what we'll see in these two men in Judges. Boaz, I think, has been tested, and he's proven his name, and he's lived up to his name. So Judges chapter 6, looking at verse 12, we have an individual by the name of Gideon that looks kind of weak. He's hiding. And by the way, guess who the enemies are?
Midianites.
The Midianites. And so the Midianites have kind of afflicted God's people and stolen all the crops, and so Gideon is hiding and trying to thresh out some wheat so that nobody catches him doing it. So does he look like a mighty man of valor doing this? It says in verse 11 of chapter 6, "And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under the oak, which was in Ophrah, that pertained to Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites." Boy, doesn't he look like a mighty man of valor. The Lord knows what we are before we do. All the qualities are there in us to exercise that valor, that strength, that might, that testimony of Christ, but it seems as though it's the trials in our life that bring us to a point where we are cast upon our dependence on the Lord, and he draws forth from us those traits. He knows they're there, and until we need to use them or draw upon them, we don't know that they're there. Gideon didn't know he was a mighty man of valor, because in verse 12 it says, "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." I'm sure Gideon thought, who me? Probably looked around and thought, are you talking to the right person? Are you sure you've got the right person here? Here I am hiding, trying to thresh out some wheat so nobody can catch me, and you're calling me a mighty man of valor? Down in verse 14 it says, the angel goes on and says, "And the Lord looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent thee? Go in this thy might." Gideon has just confessed in verse 13 that he is not very strong. I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person. I have no might. What he has done is confessed his weakness and looked at God. And that's our might. We confess our weakness and we look at the Lord. Our might comes from his strength. When the Apostle Paul wrote the Corinthians, he said, he asked the Lord three times to deliver him from something. And the Lord, after three times, said no. And told him, my strength is made perfect in weakness. And so Gideon didn't know he was strong until God put him in a position where he was forced to depend upon the Lord for that strength. He put him in an impossible situation. He put him in a situation where he was to defeat the Midianite army with 300 men. And the Lord, of course, is the one that defeated them. But he did it because he drew upon the Lord's strength and not his own. The other person that this is said of is in the 11th chapter of Judges. Judges chapter 11, and looking at the very first verse. And here is another person by the name of Jephthah. And here you wouldn't think that he was anything, but it says, now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. So Gilead has this son by the name of Jephthah by a harlot, and he doesn't think that he's anything, but he's called a mighty man of valor before he ever does anything. He flees from his brethren, and we find here that the Lord is going to use him in a mighty way to deliver God's people. If you get a chance, read those two chapters, chapter 6 of Judges and chapter 11 of Judges. But what I wanted you to think about when Boaz is called a mighty man of wealth, he's called that because he's already been proven, he's already been tested, he already has exercised that strength that the Lord has given him. This isn't just physical strength, this is spiritual strength. This just isn't physical might, this is spiritual might. This is a man that over the years has trusted in God. So you find this testimony of him, he was a mighty man of wealth. And then you find the next thing said about him, he was related to Elimelech. And remember what the meaning of Elimelech's name is in chapter 1? My God is king. That's the meaning of the family name. He's of the family of Elimelech. So that meaning of the name Elimelech, my God is king, in a sense applies to him also. And the difference is, whereas Elimelech in chapter 1 didn't live up to the meaning of that name, that family name, Boaz does. God is his king. Because you see, immediately, the first words out of his mouth are, the Lord be with you. He's acknowledged in his life. And so you find a difference between him and Elimelech, whatever their relationship was. His name is Boaz. And Boaz means, in him is strength, or strength. Think about that. A mighty man of wealth whose name is Boaz, strength, or in him is strength. And you look at it this way, if you take the definition in him is strength, it doesn't necessarily mean in Boaz is strength, but in God is his strength, because God is his king. My God is king. Therefore, if I lay hold of him in that way, in God is my strength. So he had this testimony of strength, because God was in his life. And I think his strength was twofold. It was maybe a strength of body, but I think it was a strength of spirit that you see here. The other, I guess, picture of why Boaz shows strength is over in 1 Kings 7:21. There are two pillars that are mentioned in the house of the Lord. And in 1 Kings 7:21, we find the name of those two pillars. And what do you think the purpose of a pillar would be literally? Hold up something. So would you say a pillar would have to be strong? A pillar holds things up. And so in 1 Kings 7:21, this is the only other place you find the name Boaz. And he set up pillars. This is Solomon building the temple. And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar and called the name thereof Jachin, which means he will establish. And he set up the left pillar and called the name thereof Boaz. In him is strength. And so you find a visible picture of strength. It's a pillar. One of the things that we find Jesus talking about as a reward to one of the seven churches in Revelation is, you will be a pillar in the house of my God. There is a strength that can be applied to our lives through our dependence on him. Here the strength comes from residing in the house of God. Isn't that where we get our strength? Residing in the house of God? That's where that pillar was. That's where the strength comes from. He was from the tribe of Judah, because they're in the land of Judah, and Judah means praise. And if you are to look at his genealogy, what his grandfather was called a prince of Judah. Over in, I think it's 2 Chronicles 3:17 and 1 Kings 7:21, you find the genealogy of Boaz, and his grandfather is called a prince of Judah. That means there was a, in a sense, royalty there. They were leaders among the tribes in Judah, so he would have been a leader in the tribe of Judah. So I wanted you to think about these names here. The last thing I wanted you to think about, and next week if we have time, I wanted to give you the names of all his ancestors, because each of their names has a meaning and you can see Christ in all those names. But the other thing I wanted you to think about is, he has an ancestor whose name is Rahab. And Rahab was a harlot, and she was a Canaanite. She wasn't an Israelite. So think about this. If one of his ancestors was Rahab the harlot that we find in the book of Joshua that hid the spies, that means he might have a different attitude towards Ruth the Moabite. My ancestor was Rahab the harlot, a Canaanite. Here is Ruth the Moabite, but she loves God just like Rahab loved God. Therefore, I'll show grace unto her. And you can kind of see that that would affect how he would perceive her. So this week, go forward in the strength that the Lord provides.